It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. An hour focused on foreign affairs this program. Let's talk now with a recent University of Iowa graduate who's been performing some interesting military work in Afghanistan. Lieutenant Colonel James Fielder is a senior intelligence officer and air intelligence advisor with the 438th Air Expeditionary Advisory Group. He served in Afghanistan in 2013 and 2014. He's a graduate of the University of Iowa. Lieutenant Colonel James Fielder, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
You'll be speaking tomorrow, Wednesday, at the Iowa City Council on Foreign Relations. Your presentation is titled Putting Theory into Practice, Applying Political Science to Afghanistan Operations. We want to learn a little bit about the expertise that you'll be sharing at that event. First of all, tell us a little bit about your position and your goals in that position while you were in Afghanistan.
Yes. So while I was there, I basically had two primary goals. My first goal was to be a American advisor to Afghan Air Force personnel at Kabul Air Wing in Kabul, Afghanistan. And my second goal was I was also the U.S. Intelligence leader for the 438th Air Expeditionary Advisory Group, where basically I advised my own commander on threats to NATO personnel and Afghan Air Force personnel stationed in Kabul.
Mm-hmm. Now, you applied some political science theories to two very different aspects of your work in Afghanistan. Can you tell us what you set out to do in each case and how you use these models?
Right. Well, so for my first goal, to advise the Afghans, I used a political communication model. And basically, I guess I should say understanding noise inside of communication is very important if you want to successfully transmit a message from a sender to a receiver and back. And part of noise could be cultural, language differences, time differences, and so on. And in my training, when I was working with the Afghans, I was trying to improve their own communications processes, but at the same time learn about more how they communicated so I could do a better job of letting them use their own methods to succeed. Mm-hmm. Well, what happened is, unfortunately, on May 2, 2014, there was a serious mudslide in Badakhshan province in northern Afghanistan that unfortunately killed 2,500 people. Well, that presented at least a chance for us to try our new processes. Typically, using traditional communications channels, it would take anywhere from 4 to 7 days to do an airborne intelligence surveillance and reconnaissance mission, or ISR for short. So we, after it happened, myself and my Afghans got together and said, you know what, let's make this happen. We're going to fly an aircraft up there. We're going to take some pictures and see if we can use this for humanitarian purposes. And we used what I would say the Afghan communication method, as opposed to doing a very formal hierarchical process. We used their methods, their cell phones, their social contacts, their levels of trust. And what we were able to, from start to finish, from taking off, coming back, landing, producing images, and sending them to decision makers, it took us 7 hours. Or traditionally, it had taken 4 days. And for me, that was a sign of a successful communication and action, and it really warmed my heart to see it. These images were actually used to support humanitarian work up in northern Africa.
Mm-hmm. Explain a little bit about what this has to do with the theory you talked about, noise in communication, in choosing the Afghan communication methods.
Right. So when you get off the plane in Afghanistan, I mean, there's noise everywhere, at least from the Western perspective. You know, you're learning about a new culture. You're learning about slight divisions in religious denominations. You're learning about different ethnic groups. And what you're really trying to do is resist thinking like yourself. If I think like myself as a Westerner, then I'm going to impose my own biases and thus my own noise into the process. But by establishing trust and social capital with my Afghan counterparts, learning how they work, watching how they build relationships, watching what it takes for them to send a message to their own channels, it reduces a lot of friction, if you will.
I imagine it gains trust as well.
It does. Matter of fact, the doing little things, you know, having a meal with them, having tea with them, learning a little bit of their languages, it goes a long way towards establishing rapport.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be a little surprised when I would see fellows who would be resistant to wanting to get to know their Afghans. And I'd say, if you really want to do a job well here, let alone make friends, try to get to know them, know what makes them tick, and in turn, they're going to learn what makes you tick.
So that's very interesting what you say, resist thinking like yourself. We've been in Afghanistan for a long time. How much of our military, our interaction with the Afghan people goes according to what seems to be a very valuable rule that you've learned, resist thinking like yourself instead of applying Western American communication models to them?
I would say it's improved dramatically since the war started. Now anyone who deploys in theater has to go through cultural awareness training, and they learn a little bit of the language. They're not going to become fluent in such a short amount of time, but at least, you know, greetings, how to order food and say hello and thank you and whatnot. Learn how to not offend their hosts, if you will. I'd say the one lingering issue that I can't think of a solution to overcome is that we go there for 6 months at a time. We go there for a year at a time. It's not that I want to be there necessarily for 5 years myself, but imagine Doctor Who taking place where 400 people all leave at the same time and then 400 new people come at the same time. So you have to have, you're constantly having to rebuild trust, where maybe it takes them 2 or 3 months to get to know me. I work with them, and I leave. And then the process starts over.
And you see this as a primary problem that I guess we can't solve because Americans do not want to stay over there for longer than these tours.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. Now, you will have people who will go back again and again over time, and they'll know the area, they'll know the culture. But even so, it's you're still going to get enough new people coming constantly that there's always going to be churn, if you will.
Lieutenant Colonel James Fielder is my guest, Senior Intelligence Officer and Air Intelligence Advisor with the 438th Air Expeditionary Advisory Group. He spent time in Afghanistan serving in the military from October 2013 to December 2014. He's a University of Iowa graduate. You applied some models to a presidential election there, the recent presidential election. What did you do there with those models?
Right. So my second goal then was to always keep my own commander updated on threats to Afghan personnel and NATO personnel stationed in Kabul. And since 2014 was a big year, not just a Afghan presidential election, but it was the first one in modern Afghan history where it was two new candidates. The incumbent President Karzai was leaving office. So there was a chance to see a real political battle taking place. And when I say political battle, it's not quite the same as the United States. There could actually be a battle. He said, Colonel Fielder, Pigeon, I need you to tell me everything you know about the election, everything you know about politics in Afghanistan, what the threats are to people working inside of Kabul. Yes, sir. So I read up on how government works in Afghanistan, how the previous presidential elections worked, and watching how the system worked, it made me think of the median voter theorem, which dates to Hotelling in 1929 and used since then, where basically states that if you have basically two major candidates running against each other along a left-to-right spectrum, and that would be policy preferences, then the candidate who's going to win is not going to be the one who appeals to just the fringe left or the fringe right. He's going to be the one who, or she is going to be the one who appeals to the large balance of median voters, average voters, the ones who, they get their regular cereal, they buy their Starbucks every day, they consider themselves politically moderate, they don't have any serious political preferences. Well, looking at that model, and then looking how elections work in Afghanistan, I saw that there seemed to be a very strong ethnic component, where instead of a left or right spectrum in Afghanistan, it was, I'm going to vote for the Tajik, or I'm going to vote for the Pashtun. So based on researching previous elections, I theorized that because the Pashtuns are the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan, the Pashtun candidate is going to win. Now, what makes this different than the United States is, unlike the U.S., where you're basically after the campaigns and the nominations, you're going to have two people who run, maybe with a third party candidate. Afghanistan, they'll have two. They'll have an initial election and a runoff election. The initial one, there will be maybe 15 candidates. Well, but just like the United States, you had to have 50.1% of the vote. So that first election, it's almost mathematically impossible for that one person to get the majority vote. Mm-hmm. So what I saw, we expected to happen, myself and my intel team, was we saw there were 9 Pashtun candidates, 1 Tajik. Said the Pashtun's not going to win because their vote's going to be divided. The Tajik is going to take the preponderance, that would be Dr. Abdullah, but he's not going to get the majority. And that's exactly what happened.
And that's how we ended up with Ashraf Ghani.
Yes, because the second one went to the runoff. Now, instead of the Pashtuns having their loyalties divided between different candidates, they said, we have one Pashtun candidate. And since ethnic loyalty is very powerful in Afghanistan, we are going to vote for the Pashtun, not the Tajik. And because of that, the Pashtun won. Now, long-term politically, I don't know what this says about the health of presidential elections in Afghanistan. It suggests that the Pashtun candidate will always win as long as there is a strong ethnic component. Near term, as for more concern to my colonel, like what were the threats, by knowing what the ethnic groups were, knowing where they lived in Kabul, knowing where the choke points were around town, we were able to recommend where to avoid traffic, where to increase security, where to send more aircraft. And because of that, we used political science theory to ensure that no Afghan forces and no native forces were killed or injured in any type of violence throughout Kabul. Now, I do want to make another point here, though, when it comes to violence. We were lucky in that, lucky I say in air quotes, and only about 48 Afghans were killed in ethnic violence or election violence throughout Afghanistan this year versus hundreds in 2009. Now, I can't imagine what it would be like in the United States if someone on CNN said, we had a great election year, only 48 people were killed in the United States because of election violence. And
yeah.
Really put it into context.
You were there in 2013 and 2014. This war has been going on since 2003. I wonder if you can give us some context. You were there for just over a year. How does the Afghanistan now compare with the Afghanistan you left in 2014? Also in the larger context of this very long war?
Well, while I was there, I do know the Afghan Air Force personnel I worked with, they were very happy that we were there. They were very reluctant to see us leave. But that also, my perspective was almost entirely through Tajik eyes. Most of the Afghan Air Force is Tajik. They were Dari speakers. And I learned Persian Farsi when I was earlier in my career, and it was a dialect close enough to Dari that I could have conversations with my Afghans. They had a different mindset than maybe the southern Pashtuns or even the central Hazaras. Just talking, though, to other peers who had worked with Pashtuns down south, so they were a little more hesitant. They were a little more ambivalent about American forces or NATO forces being there. I left then in 2014 thinking if we were at least on the right track. But with ongoing political issues, and when I say that, I mean that I know the Ghani government is still slow in appointing some senior-level policymakers. We have increased resurgence of Taliban throughout Afghanistan, particularly in Kunduz. And we were supposed to have the drawdown, but speaking personally, but not as a representative of the military, I got to say I'm actually glad that we are leaving forces there. Not that I want to put people at risk, but between some political hesitancy on the part of the Afghans increased Taliban activity. I think it's, if we want to do this right, I think we need to have more people there. I think we're still on the right track. I do think we're still on the right track, but it's going to take a while more.
Lieutenant Colonel James Fielder is my guest. He's worked in intelligence and has served in Afghanistan in 2013 and 2014. I wonder what you think are the biggest misconceptions we have about the Afghan people and the Afghan war.
Okay. I would say the two biggest issues are that the Afghans are cowards and the Afghans are lazy. I can unequivocally state that neither are true. They're Afghans, speaking in generalist terms, because they will think of themselves as Hazara first or Pashtuns first or Tajiks first. But they're, generally speaking, across Afghanistan, a warrior culture. They have a lot of pride in their work. They will stand what they believe in, and they will fight tenaciously. And I'd say they have a very strong work ethic. However, their sense of time is different than Americans or NATO personnel who go there. I would say Americans are going to be very by the book, on time, have a meeting, let's do this fast, let's do it right, let's do it now. The Afghan way is a little more deliberate. Let's get to know each other. Let's establish trust. And now we know each other. Let's work together. And yeah, it might take longer, but we'll build it right the first time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's constantly overlooked. And that goes back to what I said about don't think like yourself, think like an Afghan. Once you learn that, everything makes sense. Once you gain that patience, everything will work.
Tell me a little bit, but before we have to say goodbye here, what your day-to-day work was like as working in intelligence in Afghanistan. Take us through a typical day, and did you have much contact with, did you know of the presence of any Taliban or Al-Qaeda while you were working?
I got to say, I never knew of the presence, but we could never let our guard down. We always had to walk in pairs everywhere we went. And I certainly was in situations where I was vastly outgunned, and if someone had decided to turn on me, I would have no recourse. But I figured in order to do anything, I had to take some level of personal risk, and I was willing to do that. Daily, I would be at work by 7 o'clock in the morning. I would read about an hour of intel reports from throughout Afghanistan, and if I had time, a little bit of a broader Middle East as well. And then I would go over to watch my Afghans give their morning intelligence brief to their own leadership and the helicopter pilots. And then we'd work with them, I'd say, at least 3 to 4 hours a day. And sometimes by work, I mean actually doing teaching them tradecraft, map reading, land navigation, visual recognition, to just sitting with them and watching Bollywood movies and drinking tea. To them, that was very important. To me, it gave me a greater appreciation for Bollywood movies.
Bollywood?
Yes. They loved Indian movies. Loved them. I got to say, it was one of the more memorable. There's certain actors. I can't remember some of their names. If I still see them on Indian movie posters, I immediately think of being with my guys.
Right. It sounds like
then in the afternoon, we would go back to studying. We'd go back to our own work, helping our own commander, gather reports. And then once a week, we'd give our weekly intelligence briefing to the commander and the entire group staff.
It sounds like you approached it with real dedication and passion, and you have some fondness for your time there. Will you be returning to Afghanistan?
Honestly, I doubt it. At this point in my career, I think that actually might be the last time I ever deploy. I'm going back to the Air Force Academy next summer to be a senior military professor. And generally speaking, you don't deploy from those positions unless you volunteer. So we shall see. But I will be, if they tell me to go, hey, I'm trained to do it, so I'm ready whenever they say.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea, having worked on the ground in intelligence in Afghanistan, how this will end? Of course, that's the big political question here, now that we're not completely getting out of Afghanistan, as we hear in the reports from the White House.
It will end when the average Afghan feels secure. I would say maybe the third misconception about Afghanistan was that they all want to join the Taliban, or they all have terrorist sympathy, or, you know, they're all, or a majority extremist views, if you will, or anti-American. No, it's just like us. They just want to raise their families. They want to be left alone. They want to know they can get a job. When you look at the Taliban resurgence, it's more of a sense of, I don't like the Taliban, but when they're in power, nobody bothers me. Whereas if I see the Americans pulling out, and now I'm worried about my security and the safety of my family, that's a problem. We've got to tap into that. We have to let them know that they're safe, and let them know that security, that they have a strong, secure, and stable government that will take care of them.
Okay, thank you very much, Lieutenant Colonel James Fielder, Senior Intelligence Officer and Air Intelligence Advisor with the 438th Air Expeditionary Advisory Group, serving in Afghanistan in 2013 and 2014. Speaking tomorrow, Wednesday, at the Iowa City Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you very much, Lieutenant Colonel James Fielder.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.